This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. High school seniors, like everybody else, have had a strange year. Quarantining, on again, off again, virtual classes, missing out on a lot of the social aspects of school. And it has some of them rethinking their college plans. A new survey from a marketing group finds that a third of potential college students are reconsidering whether to pursue a higher degree. And schools around the country say fewer applications are coming in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a student in the middle of making these choices or the parent of a student, have your plans changed? Are you rethinking the type of school you'd want to go to? Has the COVID-19 pandemic changed the way you're looking at this decision? How about affordability? How about concerns about doing it online, at least at first? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Scott Jasek is the editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here again.
Well, let's start with that marketing company survey I mentioned, Scott. Just one data point out there among many. But what kind of things did they find when they asked prospective students what their plans were?
Well, they found that potential students are very freaked out about what's going on. I mean, look, they can either enroll in a college that is all online or that invites students back, but may still have all their classes online. They can't have much of a social life in college today. They may not be able to play sports, all kinds of things, and they might get sick. So many students are rethinking what they want to do.
And I guess a big question mark here is the big question mark that we don't know what life is going to look like come September 2021, right? It could be that they're in classes enjoying the full college experiences. It could be they're on a computer at home.
Right. I mean, colleges are right now struggling to figure out what to do in the spring semester, which starts in January, February. That is a long, you know, the next year is a long ways off, and it could be lots of great things could happen. The vaccine could be, you know, distributed and everyone could be safe. When's the last time everything went perfectly on a big national public health initiative?
So what are we seeing when it comes to, first of all, college enrollment now? Before we get to applications for 2021, what are the trends for colleges with the number of students attending this academic year?
Sure. Well, overall, according to the National Student Clearinghouse, enrollment is down 3.3%. But freshman enrollment is down 13%. Community college freshman enrollment is down at 19%. Medical schools, law schools have applications going up. So it really depends who you are. And then within that total, generally low-income students, minority students are less likely to apply than white students or wealthy students.
Let's focus in on the community colleges, the technical colleges around the country. Because one thought might have happened was students thinking, okay, if I can't go to a campus and get the full college experience, if I'm doing this online, why not do things online at a less expensive community college or technical college? That isn't panning out, though, in terms of enrollment, it sounds like.
Right. I mean, a lot of people thought what you did, but it's not coming true because, one, a lot of community college students are not set up well at home for online education. Community colleges, for instance, are opening up Wi-Fi in their parking lots so students can come to campus and study in a parking lot. Now, in a Wisconsin winter, that might not be so attractive. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that they're dealing with. Many community college students are also, frankly, poor, and they are struggling like everyone to put food on the table, and college education may seem valuable for the future, but may not be what they most go for now.
Now, what about the campuses with that on-campus experience where students come in and think about, you know, living in dorms and going to the football games and things like that? How are those campuses trying to navigate this declining enrollment this year?
They are, you know, doing everything they can. First of all, it depends what the students, you know, what the student experience is like. But at many campuses, do not have anyone visiting, And for a campus recruiting students, the best thing you can have is a student visit. That's, you know, they kill for student visits. But the students can't visit, so they've had to create virtual visits, a variety of tools showing what campus life is like. But this is good and maybe the best they can come up with, but it's not good enough. And so they're losing some students.
We're talking to Scott Jasek right now, editor of Inside Higher Ed, about how potential college students are, in many cases, rethinking their next steps. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you that we're talking about, or your kid, if you're a parent of a high school senior making those college plans? If you are already in college, what has been different? Has it led you to rethink what you're doing, maybe to transfer or maybe take a gap year? If you work in higher education, what are you seeing when it comes to people coming to campus virtually, applying for 2021? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Ed, looking at the dip in college applications so far this year. Surveys showing more students reconsidering their higher education plans. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is calling from outside of Milwaukee. Rebecca, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Rebecca?
So I have a daughter who's a senior in high school, and I find this whole conversation fascinating because I think a year ago, she would have headed on to a four-year college. She was looking forward to it. I think that was exciting for her. She had the grades to do it. And I think all of this has kind of thrown everything up in the air, and now she's like, do I go to college? Do I go to a two-year school at first? Because maybe they'll be online. It'll be cheaper in the beginning, and if I'm being online anyways, I might as well just do that. So it's just kind of one of those things where I think kids really want to decide now what's going to actually be something I can do and I know for sure that's concrete.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for sharing your daughter's experience. Scott, Rebecca's daughter, not alone in trying to maybe juggle and make plans that she hadn't thought she'd have to make a year ago.
No, but at the same time, I think she's got a good plan. Community colleges offer a great education. And, you know, and you can encourage your daughter to study hard and then she can transfer when things get better. I think she's got a good head on her shoulders and is headed in the right direction.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Buck calling from Sturgeon Bay. Buck, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Buck?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'm a self-employed master plumber in Wisconsin. And I'm also on the board of directors for the Wisconsin Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors Association. And our board is in charge of, you know, continuing ed. Well, one of the people responsible for helping get continuing ed classes to plumbers and HVAC guys. And I've got a 16-year-old son in high school. And when the COVID hit and kids were sent home from school and he was homeschooling, he would be at home and I'd come home from work and, you know, the trades are extremely busy. And he kind of had an epiphany and he said, you know, Dad, he goes, you're working 8 days a week. Mom's still busy working. And, you know, I was thinking of college and there's a lot of college educated people sitting at home right now. And I'm thinking maybe I want to go into the trade. I'd never been one to want to push my kids into what I think they should do and figure that it's better for them to come up with their ideas naturally. And as the summer progressed and I was busy and unfortunately restaurants and bars are closing and a lot of people are, you know, the big cities sitting at home working in their apartments, confined to their apartments. I've never slowed down less than 50 hours a week since the last 2 years.
Wow. Buck, thanks a lot for calling in. Scott, Buck's son thinking, hey, maybe go into trades like Dad. And I don't know, is that some, I don't know if we have data on that. Is that something we're seeing other people consider?
It is. I would caution, though, these days in many of the trades, it's still important to go to a community college, a vocational college, get some skills that go with whatever trade he wants to pursue. So it doesn't have to mean writing off all of higher education.
Thanks for that call, Buck. Before we bring on another caller, Scott, what are we seeing so far? I know it's college application season now. I know it very well from my own family. What are we seeing in application numbers so far?
Well, in application numbers so far, I think they're going to be, they may be up, but they will be up from more people applying to more colleges. So I don't know that they're really up. The other big thing we're seeing is the SAT and ACT. Most colleges have gone SAT or ACT optional. And so a lot of students for the first time are deciding whether or not to submit SAT and ACT scores.
Let's bring on another caller now. Rana is with us in Rice Lake. Rana, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've been wanting to talk about this subject for quite some time because it's directly affecting my daughter, who is a senior at UW-Madison. She's double majoring in two engineering programs, which is difficult enough when it's face-to-face. But she says now that everything is online, it has just put so much more stress on her to be able to, she's got a 3.5 too, to be able to maintain her everything, that she feels the stress, the angst. She wants to complete her degree, but she just doesn't know how, when. Should I take a gap year and travel? Should I just go out and try and find a job? It's the pressures of the uncertainty of everything that just become unsurmountable on top of an already challenging career path that she's very suited for, but finding herself very frustrated. And I'm sure there's others out there in that. I just wish there was some kind of solution for us all. But thank you.
Rana, thank you so much for calling in. Good luck to your daughter in getting through that. Scott, I assume this is not just Rana's daughter. A lot of students, especially in difficult fields like that, having trouble doing this all online.
All students are really suffering from mental health problems right now. You know, your daughter is typical, not unusual. But the important thing to know is that even studying online, a lot of campus clinics for mental health are open, are serving students. So, and there's a range of services available. So check with those services and encourage your daughter to continue her good work in college.
Thanks for that call. Scott, in our last half a minute or so, what are the next big things you're watching for when it comes to data or how schools are dealing with this as we keep going on through this winter?
The main thing will be what their spring semester plans are. Many colleges are announcing that they plan to be back and be more in person, but the COVID cases are taking off like crazy in campus communities and in all of our communities. And so we're going to have to watch and wait and see what happens.
Scott, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you.
Scott Jasek is the editor at Inside Higher Ed. He was with us to talk about how students are rethinking college because of the COVID-19 pandemic and concerns about online education, affordability, and more. Coming up after the news, some states have smartphone apps to help with contact tracing to stop the spread of coronavirus. Why don't more people know about them? Why don't more communities use them? We'll learn about the apps and how they could be more helpful. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, we know that masks and physical distancing are effective ways of slowing the spread of coronavirus. If you have a smartphone, you have another tool, mobile technology, that can help notify you if you've been in close proximity with someone who may have the virus. It could make a difference if people and states use this capability for contact tracing. But less than half of the states in the U.S. have developed a system for harnessing this technology. Wisconsin, for one, has not. Jeffrey Fowler is a technology columnist for The Washington Post. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what are these contact tracing apps, probably available on all of our cell phones, though maybe not up and running in every state? Give us the basics of how they work.
Yeah, so they're called exposure notification apps. So it's a little bit different than contact tracing. We can return to that in just a minute. But what exposure notification apps do is they let you know if you happen to spend time close to somebody who later gets a positive COVID test diagnosis. The way they do that is they use the Bluetooth on your phone. Now, Bluetooth is something we normally associate with maybe AirPods or connecting our phone to our car. Turns out Bluetooth wireless can also be used to measure the distance between people. So once you turn on one of these systems or install one of these apps on your phone, it is sort of quietly in the background, keeping track of every time you got within 6 feet of another phone for more than 15 minutes and making a note of that anonymously. And then if that person you were near later gets a diagnosis, they can push out an alert and make your phone pop up something that says something like, you have likely been exposed. You should go get a COVID test.
I think a lot of people hear this, and you write about this in your piece on this, Jeff, and think, whoa, I worry about my privacy here. What in the kinds of apps you're talking about, how do they address that concern?
Yeah, this is kind of the number one concern that Americans have about this technology, and with good reason. There, companies, cell phone companies, Apple and Google, as well as the government, have not done a very good job in America of making us trust them. This particular system, though, they've done a pretty good job with. I'm the tech columnist for The Washington Post, and most of the time my job is poking holes in the latest technology or wagging a finger at these companies for the way that they handle our privacy. But in this case, they figured out how to make these kinds of alerts work totally anonymously. And the key thing to know here is that it does not collect your location. So the GPS stuff on your phone that's used for Google Maps and other things, it doesn't use that at all. Instead, it's only collecting these anonymous Bluetooth signals from the people you happen to be nearby. There's no central database of everybody's Bluetooth signals or anything like that. It's all stored locally on your phone. And when you do get an alert on your phone, you don't know who you were exposed to or even when exactly. It just says, you were likely exposed. You should get a test.
Part of the story is getting people to activate this on their phones, but another part is to put this into practice at the state or community level. This is not universal in the country. How common is it for local or state governments to have this system in place?
Yeah, like a lot of other aspects of America's response to the COVID crisis, this technology has been done locally. There is no federal system like there is, frankly, in some other countries. There's a nationwide system using this technology. So in the U.S., every single state and territory has to develop their own technology. Some of them have made their own apps to do it. Some have just been working with Apple and Google, who developed kind of the framework of this to make it work automatically on phones. So far, there are 17 states and territories in the U.S. plus Washington, D.C. that have done this. So right now it's available to about 110 million Americans.
Is there a success story? Is there a state we can look at and say, yes, they've put this into place. People have signed up for it and it seems to be working. It seems to be letting people know, hey, you have been exposed.
It's still pretty early days, so we should start with that. The first of these in the United States rolled out in August in the state of Virginia, and it's only been in the last, I would say, 2 or 3 weeks that we've really seen a lot more turn on. So maybe a little early to know. But one example is just this week, Washington State went live with these, and within the first 4 days, they had 1 million people turn on the exposure alerts on their phones. That's, you know, about 15% of the state. And there's some research out of Oxford that says with at least 15% of a population using a system like this, it could already be preventing deaths. So part of the challenge here, though, in measuring the success of this is it's anonymous. For all those reasons that we were talking about before, that people are concerned about privacy, data does not go back to state health departments about the number of people that are getting alerts and who those people are. And in fact, some state health departments don't like this technology because of that. They say it's not as useful as it could be in doing exposure tracking and contact tracing because it is anonymous.
Talking to Jeff Fowler, technology columnist for The Washington Post, about available technology on smartphones to alert people if they've been exposed to someone with COVID-19, if they've been in proximity, I guess technically if their phones have been in proximity with one another. And Jeff, a lot of states, Wisconsin included, haven't done this. You were just starting to touch on one reason it hasn't been picked up anywhere. What has been, is it are states consciously rejecting this, or they got so much going on and they're, you know, doing everything else they can, they just haven't stumbled onto this yet? What's going on?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of issues. One, when this technology was first proposed by Apple and Google together back in the spring, there was a lot of legitimate concern that this is technology solutionism. It's a Silicon Valley, once again, thinking there's no problem that can't be solved without, with an app. And, you know, those are legitimate concerns. And so some states at that point decided this was not worth their resources because it does require them to either make an app or develop some kind of system, you know, at a time when resources, particularly for health departments, are strained. Technological resources may not be there as well. The good news is since then, though, it's gotten a lot easier and a lot less expensive for states to roll out this kind of technology. I know the state of New York did it recently for under $700,000 using a system that didn't even require them to make an app for folks with iPhones. It just sort of, you just go into the settings on the phone and turn it on. So it's getting easier for states to do this, but some just have other priorities.
Have we seen other countries do this at a nationwide level and have success with it?
Yeah, we have. The first was Switzerland, and they've been very open about the data, and researchers are studying and combing through that data right now to see if there's any signs of its effectiveness, and they think there are some initial ones. The UK has a system like this. Early in the coronavirus pandemic, you might have heard about people using phones in places like Singapore and South Korea. They were actually using a different technology. They were actually tracking people's locations with the phone. And that was the idea that scared a lot of Americans. And so we did not go that direction, nor did most of the rest of the world.
Are there other types of apps related to either exposure alerts like the ones we're mainly talking about or contact tracing or other ways to try to stop the spread of COVID-19? And how widely are they used, if so?
Yeah, there is another app that was made by a popular kind of police and crime tracking service called Citizen. Some listeners may have heard of Citizen. They made their own exposure tracking system called SafePass. It's an app you have to install on your phone. I think they've had more difficulty getting people to sign on and use it. And it's also not affiliated with state health departments. So it relies on people submitting their own and telling the truth about their own COVID tests. So I'm not certain I can 100% recommend that one. You're really better off with these systems that are coming from the state health departments.
Now, if a state like, say, Wisconsin were to say, okay, yeah, we want to do this exposure alert system on phones, what kind of, I guess, PR effort does it take to get people within the state's borders to activate their phones and to join in?
Yeah, this is such a good question because this is such a complicated problem. You have both the technology that you have to work out. First, you got to figure out how to make Bluetooth wireless, measure the distance between people and figure out the difference between a phone being in someone's pocket versus in their hand. A lot of technical things to work out. You got to get all these state health departments to kind of connect in with technology. That's a whole other challenge. And then there's this marketing challenge, right? You know, as we were saying, Americans are really skeptical about their privacy with good reason. So you have to convince them to go into their phone and either install an app or turn on some things that, you know, are kind of complicated and hard to explain and have to take a minute. And you have to trust that somebody has really, you know, made sure that they have your best interest and your privacy in mind. For that reason, I actually think Apple and Google have been almost sort of criminally negligent in not marketing these technologies. I mean, think about how many ads have you seen this fall for the new iPhone 12 and its 5G or the new Apple Watch. The future of health is on your wrist, they say. And yet they have put almost no effort into marketing this technology that they helped develop for state health departments and country health departments. And I don't get that. I mean, Silicon Valley is very good at marketing and explaining technology to citizens. So it ought to be playing a role as well, and not just relying on health departments and, you know, politicians to do this. I mean, if the best thing you've got going for you is the state's governor going on air begging you to download an app, you're in trouble.
Switching gears, Jeff, I know there's been talk about, okay, if people have developed an immunity to coronavirus, either by having had it, hopefully that makes them immune for a while, or by getting a vaccine, hopefully soon, the idea of some kind of ID, physical card, or digital technology, what's in the works out there when it comes to that?
Yeah, this is another big potential technological solution or hurdle, depending on how we handle it. You know, when you get that shot, how will you prove that you've gotten that shot? Would that become useful as a tool for knowing, for example, who can go back to work or who can get on a plane? Right now, I've been sort of talking to folks in the industry. It doesn't look like the U.S. has a system in place, at least not yet, to make that happen via the internet or your phone in a way that couldn't be spoofed by other people. The only thing I've heard so far is that the U.S. Army wants to give you a printed out little card that you get, physical piece of paper, after you get a shot, which of course could be probably reproduced by anybody with a photocopy machine, and is maybe not the most secure way to figure out who has and has not gotten the vaccine. So, but it's still possible. There's still time that maybe we'll figure out something, possibly using our phones as a way to securely identify who has and has not gotten that vaccine.
Jeff, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
You bet.
Jeff Fowler is a technology columnist at the Washington Post. We talked to him today about how contact tracing technology and exposure alert technology on phones could help fight the spread of coronavirus in the U.S. There are some issues that need to be addressed to make it more effective, in part getting states and people to start using it.